Podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley, and this is the National Gallery Podcast. Coming up in this month's episode.
It's very disconcerting. I've always thought that that sort of distortion of her face made her look more like a monkey than a human woman.
We pay a visit to the gallery's big autumn exhibition to hear the ugly truth about Renaissance art. And?
Well, we've just left Hampton Court Station and taken only a few steps, and here we are at the River Thames. And we're standing in almost the exact spot where Alfred Sisley put down his easel to paint Regatta at Hampton Court in 1874.
A walk along the Thames in the footsteps of Impressionist Alfred Sisley. But we start with your chance to see and to save a masterpiece by Titian. In these credit crunch days, the press is full of stories about the investment potential of great art, though the record-breaking prices achieved at auctions lately are beyond all but a few. Well, this month we're offering everyone the opportunity to make a good investment, with a return guaranteed not just for themselves, but for millions of others too. Diana and Actaeon, a stunning work by the Italian master Titian, is up for sale. And in conjunction with the National Galleries of Scotland, we hope to raise £50 million to buy it for the nation. Leah Caribbean went to talk to Carol Platzotter to find out how everyone can help.
Well, Carol, this is a real treat, isn't it? And it's really lovely to see so many people here. But being in front of Diana and Actaeon and seeing it in the flesh, one's really immediately impressed by the sheer scale of the ambition that Titian has here.
It truly is an extraordinary work, and it was so moving when the picture first arrived to bring it in and see how it changes when you see it in a different context.
Normally you'd have to go up to Edinburgh to see it, wouldn't you, in the National Gallery of Scotland, but it's down here for a very particular reason. Can you fill us in?
We've got the painting here just for a month in order to raise consciousness in London. It hasn't been seen in London since 1945, when it was evacuated from the Bridgewater House during the war, and ever since then it's been on show in Edinburgh.
And can you tell us the story? Because people might not be familiar with Diana and Actaeon. What's going on here?
The story is taken from the Roman poet Ovid, and it is a moment of intense drama and pathos. It shows a beautiful young man, Actaeon, a hunter, who's become separated from his friends at the end of a day's hunting. And he happens upon Diana, the chaste goddess of the hunt, bathing with her voluptuous nymphs.
Now, which one is Diana?
Diana is the one seated on the right, the beautiful, quite plump goddess, and she's staring across at Actaeon with this extraordinary, haughty, proud glare, because he has caught her in a very awkward position, because she's in a state of complete undress.
Now, the campaign for raising money is called Two Masterpieces, One Chance. Now, what does that mean? Why two masterpieces?
Diana and Actaeon comes in a package which has been offered to us with its pendant. Titian designed and painted it with another very beautiful painting, another mythology, which is also a tragic and epic work called Diana and Callisto. These two paintings have never been separated. They were painted both for Philip II, and all through their history they've remained together. Their compositions are joined by the beautiful stream that runs through the foreground of both of them. It would be an absolute tragedy if they were ever to be separated.
So, as I understand it, we've got to raise £50 million by December in order to have a chance to buy the second masterpiece as well. If we don't, we lose the chance to buy both. But there are lots of people who are going to say, particularly in this current climate, £50 million, I mean, that's just too much for a picture. What do you say to that?
These works are of such supreme beauty and power. In many ways, they're akin to the late works of Beethoven or Shakespeare. They truly are in that league. It also will help to illuminate the other 11 Titians in the collection. But I have to say that it would be the absolute star of our collection and would make London one of the great places in all the world to study Titian. So what we're talking about here is an investment, a huge investment in the future of the whole nation, because by making these purchases, we will allow people to see these pictures free of charge for all time, and it can become part of our public heritage.
Leah Caribbean talking to Carol Platz-Otter. Just to recap those details, you can make a donation online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk or by calling 0207 747 5875. And if you'd like to see Titian's Diana and Actaeon for yourself, pop in. The painting will be on display throughout the month. Next up, Renaissance artists are known for their fascination with images of idealised beauty. But as visitors to our big autumn exhibition are discovering, ugliness interested them too. The wrinkled subject of one of the best-loved paintings in the show, A Grotesque Old Woman by Metsys, has horrified and delighted generations of viewers, and famously inspired Tenniel's depiction of the Duchess in Alice in Wonderland. Curators Susan Foister and Luke Sison paid her a visit to mull over the meaning of ugliness in the Renaissance world.
I must say, I've always absolutely loved this picture. I've never been quite sure why, because she's so ugly. I think when I was a child, I thought she was terribly funny. Do you think she's meant to be funny? I mean,
she obviously thinks she's very beautiful. She's wearing a very, very elaborate headdress with this long white frilly veil pinned up on this extraordinary horned headdress. I think what a lot of people won't realise is that she's not wearing an up-to-date fashion for an early 16th century portrait. She's wearing something very old-fashioned. She's wearing a dress that might be 100 years old, which might mean that she's nearly 100 years old. She's certainly wearing the fashions of her youth, and the wrinkles on her face and on her breast indicate that she might be a very old person. She's certainly very, very wrinkly.
And she's got this kind of sort of pug-nosed face. I mean, with this sort of blob at the end of it, and then this enormously long upper lip. I mean, she is grotesque, really. I mean, it's rather sort of horrifying.
It's very disconcerting. I've always thought that that sort of distortion of her face made her look more like a monkey than a human woman. It's not just the wrinkles and the jowliness. There are very strange things happening to her face and to her nose, and it seems that those sort of distortions may be ones that Metsys himself actually observed from a woman who may have had something extremely unpleasant called Paget's disease, in which the bones of the face became distorted in exactly this way, and this may have given him the idea for this grotesque head of a woman.
But do you think he can't possibly have been thinking of her sympathetically? Because, I mean, there she is with her, how can you put it, withered dugs and this little rose bud that she's pressing ardently between her cleavage. And she's a figure of fun, so presumably this isn't a lovely Renaissance piece of sympathy.
No, I think he's being very critical of her. She's an old woman looking for love, and she's made herself into a figure of fun. So he's probably done two things. He's taken somebody who in real life with that kind of illness and distortion probably was a figure of fun, because we know that people were not very sympathetic towards ugliness and deformity in the Renaissance. And then he's used that to make her into this personification of perhaps it's lust, but certainly old women were not supposed to be in love and offering little rosebuds to potential lovers, as this woman is.
But it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because after all, monkeys, to some later on at least, do symbolise lust, and she has got that slightly sort of simian quality. And this idea that both your merits and your demerits, your vices showed on the face, is something that perhaps he's kind of thinking about here to some degree. I mean, that she's actually not just a figure of fun, but something worse than that. She's somebody who's allowed her passions to control the way she actually looks.
Yes, I'm sure that for the Renaissance, exactly, she would have been somebody whose base passions had run away with her, and therefore she's more like an animal than a human being. There are none of the sort of higher feelings that she ought to be showing here. And in the Renaissance, I'm afraid it was women who tend to be criticised for these lustful thoughts more than men.
We do have a portrait of an old man who, again, is no beauty in the exhibition. This is Domenico Ghirlandaio's portrait of of an old man with his grandson. And as you can see, he's looking down very, very benignly at this beautiful little golden-haired boy. But most prominently of all is this, frankly, rather hideous nose. And what we understand now is that this is a disease called rhinophema. It's a kind of form of elderly acne. It's a ghastly thing to look forward to. But I think that the message here is very different.
Yes, this is a really sympathetic portrayal of an old man with his grandchild, which seems quite different from the rather ferocious criticism of the ugly old woman. It's a very, very sympathetic portrait, and he's somehow overcome his deformity. He's not defined by that. He's really defined by his sympathy towards his young grandson.
It's interesting, though. So, I mean, I suppose the point we take from these two pictures is that you can't make absolute generalizations about, you know, if somebody's ugly, then their character is ugly, and if somebody's beautiful, then they're necessarily beautiful on the inside.
Even though the Renaissance tendency was very much to judge the internal from the external.
Absolutely, no, absolutely. And I think perhaps we can see the Ghirlandaio as an exception to a broad rule.
And perhaps there was more latitude for portrayals of men than there was for portrayals of particularly older women.
Well, women were clearly more judged.
Susan Foister and Luke Sison. The Renaissance Faces exhibition is open throughout the month. Tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee. And if you'd like to hear more from Susan and Luke, you might like to know that they both feature on the audio guide to the show. If you tend to think of Impressionism as a French movement, our next exhibition may come as something of a surprise. Its star, Alfred Sisley, was born in Paris in the mid-19th century, and was inspired by the spirit of innovation that characterised French art in the era of Renoir, Monet and Cézanne. But the child of English parents, he was also drawn by the lure of the British landscape, which was to be the subject of some of his most extraordinary works. Our new exhibition brings together pictures from his trips to Britain, including a group of views of the Thames painted from sites that can still be visited today. Sisley worked in East Molesey, just across the river from Hampton Court, and that's where we sent Leah Caribbean. She spoke to Tony Osborne of the Molesey Local History Society, while back in the studio, curator Chris Riopel gave us his thoughts.
In his depiction of the regatta at Hampton Court, Sisley is showing us one of those two annual events that brought people, brought rowers and a crowd of tourists out to Hampton Court to spend a day on the water. It was exactly the kind of subject matter that had attracted him in France, busyness along the water. And here in England, he found something very similar, this day of festivity at Hampton Court.
Well, we've just left Hampton Court Station and taken only a few steps, and here we are at the River Thames, and we're standing in almost the exact spot where Alfred Sisley put down his easel to paint Regatta at Hampton Court in 1874.
He's supposed to have stayed at the Castle Hotel, which was removed when they built this present bridge in about 1933.
And where was the Castle Hotel?
The castle was on the little roundabout, which quite
so
near
really
us here.
Just
right,
behind us here.
Between us and the station.
And so he was able to just take his paints and come really just a few steps.
He might, in fact, have painted from the windows, for all we know.
The bridge you see at Hampton Court today is not the one that Sisley painted in the summer of 1874. However, the one there in 1874 was a feat of engineering that had attracted much attention at the time. Under the bridge at Hampton Court is one of Sisley's most audacious compositional inventions. He does the extraordinary thing of setting up his easel directly under the span of the bridge. It crosses across his head and it divides the picture almost like an old altarpiece in very distinct areas across the canvas. I can't think of any other image by a painter in the second half of the 19th century that takes this absolutely unexpected view.
We seem to have taken our life in our hands somewhat by crossing the Hampton Court Way.
Yes, it's a very dangerous crossing.
Yeah. It is a dangerous crossing, isn't it? And we've come now down onto the riverbank. You can take some steps down, and we're looking across the river, not far really from where we were before, only a few yards. and we're looking towards the footing of the old bridge. So Sisley has chosen to be very close to his hotel. I mean, I suppose that's practical, isn't it?
Well, some of these paintings are, I believe, fairly large, and they would have taken him possibly more than one day to work on. So you need to be, with oils, you need to be conveniently close to your base. You have to get everything out and lay it out, and it's quite a complicated operation.
The picture of Molesley Weir at Hampton Court shows exactly the kind of engineering infrastructure, like bridges, that attracted Sisley's attention. In France as well, he'd been attracted to those places along the Seine where modern engineering works were altering the course of the river. And here along the Thames, he found a similar structure and clearly took delight in the contrast between the placid river above and then the river breaking into rapid moving waters, white foam, as it breaks through the weir.
Well, after a few minutes walk along the towpath here, we come to the lock at Molesey. And then if you're very lucky and the lock keeper's in and he lets you, you can walk across onto a small little island. And then if you walk to the end of the island, you can see the weir. They've changed it slightly, I believe, haven't they, since Sisley's day, Tony?
Yeah, it looks as if these steps are newer than what was in his picture, because he shows a flow of water straight across, running from left to right, where those steps are now. Or it could, in fact, have been in flood. Of course, one must remember that all the upper work part, the bridge, the footbridge, and the roof over there, that's all after Sisley's time.
But essentially, this is exactly the right spot. And he was painting on an overcast day. It's actually started raining now, very helpfully. But plucky British are not to be put off. And in the picture, there are two boys that are ready to swim and another one who's taking his socks off to have a dip. It's not a very safe place to swim, I don't suppose. But the leisure and pleasure was very much what Molesey was about. Is that right in the 19th century?
It seems to have been so, because not so very far up here we've got Hurst Park, where there was prize fighting and ballooning and all sorts of other activities. And thousands of people did come down from London on a good day and go up and watch everything that was going on up there.
What is so interesting, I think, about the pictures that Sisley painted in the summer of 1874 and along this stretch of the river is that it is the moment at which an impressionist developed and trained in France saw in the English countryside the same kind of subject matter that he had come to appreciate along the Seine in France. And so it's a very important moment of English landscape and French landscape painting coming together in a very direct way.
Thanks to Chris Riopelle and Tony Osborne. If you'd like to see the works they discussed, Sisley in England and Wales opens at the National Gallery on the 12th of November. Admission is free. That's it for this episode. If you're in London this month, why not pop in? The gallery's open from 10 till 6 daily and from 10 till 9 on Wednesdays. And if you can't make it here in person, don't forget you can still enjoy the paintings online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. We'll be back in December with all the latest news and exhibition updates. Until then, goodbye.